like guy like me is just automatically trounced by like the pop stars or whatever, because I'm just put in the same arena as them and they're so much louder than me. Like then it's just kind of the wrong place, but that's the only way to go about it. It's not a great business setup.
I mean, we're all expected to be videographers and influencers and all of this at the same time, and I'm not any of those. I'm a songwriter.
I was terribly ambitious, really, both in terms of getting on top of the pops, but also in terms of getting my vision to come true.
For every Coldplay, there's 10 other Coldplays that all got signed in the same year. You know, yeah, there's a lot of broken dreams in the business.
If I had to be what they used to call a cult artist, well, then you'd have a fierce and small group, but you'd still be able to work in music and not in the laundry room at the hotel.
You know, when I started out, I was 17, I was playing the bars doing cover songs. And I just remember every now and then stumbling upon a chord progression or something and being really fascinated by what they do.
You have to make mistakes because that's the sort of edge of your seat drama that being in a band should be.
Making a hit record is tough, but maintaining success is another skill entirely. On The Art of Longevity, we explore the artist's experience of the music business from the inside. I want to find out what separates those artists and bands that have survived decades in the music business from all those who've fallen by the wayside. We follow a narrative inspired by a quote from Brett Anderson of Suede, who said that all successful artists have followed a similar career arc, like stations of the cross. The struggle, success, excess, disintegration, and if you're lucky, enlightenment. With insights and stories for music fans, aspiring musicians, and creators, this is The Art of Longevity. The Art of Longevity is presented with Bowers & Wilkins, the revered British premium audio brand. Neil and Nick from Crowded House, welcome to The Art of Longevity. How are you both?
Thank you very much. Lovely to be here. I'm doing well. I had a reasonable sleep. I came from New Zealand 2 days ago, so I was woozy yesterday, and I will probably have woozy moments later today. But at the moment, I'm in London. My feet are on the ground. My brain's in the right place.
And I came from Sligo on the west coast of Ireland, where I live. So I'm in the right time zone, pretty much.
Less woozy.
Yeah.
Maybe. I always wonder when you come over for these kind of short trips and you don't have too much time to adjust and you're thrown into this schedule, how you get by woozy. Does it sometimes help?
It can sometimes make you a little bit more lateral in your thoughts. It depends on what you're being summoned to do. And the, you know, the conversation obviously is dependent on how interesting things become. And as an interviewee, it's part of your responsibility is to keep it interesting. This nature of this kind of conversation will be easier for me with a woozy brain than one that's more sort of, right now, Neil, tell us about the new record. You know, like a radio style thing. Yeah. So that's nice.
Well, be warned, because a couple of the guests have said this is like being in a musical mind gym. So I will try and kind of get that brain whirring.
Good.
For sure.
Well, it'll be good for me.
But no, you're both very welcome. So probably the place to start would be Gravity Stairs. New record. I only listen to these records on a promotional link. You know, what I want to do is wait until I unwrap the vinyl and put it on. Mm-hmm. And it does feel like a side one and two record. Did you think about the scheduling and the packaging for vinyl this time around?
Yes. We tried a few different sequences as we were finishing in the finishing stages of the record and landed on this. You know, after a few trial and errors, and to my mind, I was thinking of two sides where you divide it. The nature of the second side is a little more of the exploratory side of the band, more deviations and twists and turns. First side is probably more straightforward in terms of the songs being understandable, maybe on first listen. Those things do seem to count for something. So, yeah, I was thinking about that.
Yeah, it felt more immediately accessible, the first side of the record, because you've got, you know, tracks like Life's Imitation, The Howl,
Oh Hi, the single, which are all upbeat, melodic, very much sort of singles type records. And then, as you say, side two is more the reflective. It feels gently psychedelic in some places.
That's nice, yeah. Well, we like gentle is much needed attribute in today's world. And psychedelic, yeah, all for it.
I asked my son, he's 11, do you know this song? I was listening to it. I was, you know, just learning Oh Hi for the session tomorrow. And I said to him, do you know this song? And he said, is this a new one? Is this on your new record? And I said, yeah. And he said, no, I haven't heard this. And I said, have you heard the record yet? And he said, no, I'm just waiting for vinyl. And which is great. I mean, he devours, well, he's a particular Beatles head on him after Get Back came out. I mean, he still likes to watch it, you know, on Netflix. Like if he can, you know, if he wants to watch something with us, he wants to watch that. He's really into the idea of records in a very old-fashioned way, I guess, as to how I devoured them when I was his age, a little bit older, actually. But, I mean, he did actually ask me, are there any singles on it? You know, which, again, I just...
Really confronting question, that. Yeah. I get that from my family sometimes as well. My sisters go, have you got any singles? And I go, well, I don't know.
He probably didn't mean it in the A&R executive frame of mind.
No, but still, exactly. I just assume.
Exactly. I did. Well, that's he might have meant it like that. So are you finally going to come up with a single, a successful hit, you guys?
Well, I'll tell you what you've done is you've gotten better at choosing the first single from your albums over the years. It's like, possibly. Oh Hi is the right first single.
I think
single.
It's a good opening gambit. The record company were keen on it, and we remade it a couple of times just for some subtle reasons of feel, for my mind anyway. But it has a backstory too, which you don't need to know, but is actually being mentioned now, that it was inspired by these kids that I ended up, well, I have been supporting this organization that builds schools in some really remote areas in Africa, and I sent a film crew up there to get some shots, and I wrote the song and see what they'd think of it, and they were dancing to it and quite really liking it, and this film came back, and I just fell in love with these kids. They were like, oh my God, it's just... So I've had that as a context and a, you know, an underpinning of the whole process, and it's given me a real... It's a lovely feeling that it's not just about whether, you know, the song's going out and doing its job in the pop world. It's actually got some kind of deeper significance for me, at least, and it really helped me.
Nick, you mentioned your son's kind of got this thing for vinyl, and there seems to be a connection between that and Netflix. It feels like every Netflix show that the kids are watching these days, someone's spinning a vinyl record. It's a great thing for the industry, and I think for artists, the resurgence of it, because your heyday was coming up through the 90s, and vinyl was nowhere. I mean, does it feel good to have it back as the, you know, the art with the principal artwork designer?
Yeah, well, I mean, contextually now, I can understand why I was fascinated by it and why I loved it as something that was a reflection of my own character, was possessing these records that said something about me. You know, this is something I could pin my sense of confidence to, you know, and I think that's what, when that went away, you know, during the post, you know, in the streaming period, a digital streaming period, I thought there was probably going to be a resurgence because of the fact that people could actually make a statement about their own character, that they could, similarly to when I was a kid, you know, that you were assessed by your record collection pretty much, you know.
Well, it brings all the senses into play, doesn't it? That's the thing. Music is obviously is an oral experience, and it works sometimes perfectly well coming out of a streaming box because you're doing things in your house and it's providing the thing, but to be able to hold something in your hands that feels nice and to look at something that looks good and play something that sounds good and read a lyric sheet or something possibly, it's bringing all your senses into play. And then if you've got a glass of wine in your hand, it's bringing almost every sense into play at that point.
And it feels like that's a nice antidote to the way we become over consumers of just about everything all at once. So it's nice to kind of use a record, an album, as a retreat from that, which I think is partly why people are coming back
definitely.
To it.
Yeah, it doesn't require a screen of any kind, which is great, you know. And one of the reasons that people still enjoy recording with multi-track tape rather than digital, and we don't always do that, but when you do have an experience recording onto tape, you realize that it's a beautiful thing not to be looking at a screen all day, and you're just staring into space and having your own images, and you've got to wind the tape back, and it takes, you know, between the first performance and the second, you might have to spend 30 seconds listening to the tape rolling back, and it's good time to reset your brain, you know. Just brings your brain into a better state.
It feels as well like it's brought a discipline to artists and bands who are kind of almost having a vision for their album being in this format. And so you're selecting, you know, just 10 or 11 songs. It's not like the CD era where you could throw on 14, 15 tracks. And, you know, going back to thinking about side one, side two, and having a feel to the record, was there another record you thought of to capture a mood for Gravity Stairs, or did you want to achieve a certain mood with it?
They just evolve records as you're digging in. The songs emerge in some way, somewhat similar fashion for me anyway, out of little demos that I make, and quite often, sometimes they're fully formed. Most of the time, they're a part of a song, revealed, and enough to certainly get on with. For example, the first song on the record, Magic Piano, was a really lovely little demo I had, but the content of that demo is quite different to what has emerged now once the band takes hold of it. And strangely, it's quite a complicated song in a way, and it was the very first thing we worked on in the studio when we got together in Byron Bay, with not many expectations of even being able to do a record at that point. We were rehearsing for a tour. And we spent 2 days learning this first song. And it was like a real deep dive into, you know, the mechanics of building a song and building a record and everyone learning how that worked and making changes and on the fly. But we got eventually a really beautiful take where everybody was very tuned in, totally had the song, but it still had the freshness of an early, you know, like felt like it was still being revealed as we were doing it. And that's a nice way to start the record in that regard, because it was our first outing, and it sort of defined a kind of mentality that the record then had. Not that everything's the same, but
yeah, I thought it was a really interesting choice for an opening song, because it has, that we were talking about feeling woozy earlier, it's got that woozy quality to it. It's got a very strong melody, but it doesn't keep to a traditional format. So it kind of goes a little bit all over. And the record is bookended as well with Night Song, which kind of does a similar thing. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of an interesting way to welcome you in and then say goodbye at the end.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about them as a bookend, but they are. Yeah, they both have twists and turns, and they kind of meander through a structure that's not obvious. Yeah, that's for sure. Especially Night Song, actually, where it changes rhythms and everything. But and within that, then after that, there are some songs that are quite straightforward, but there is sort of a moment where a song like maybe Blackwater, White Circle sort of does a similar meandering and you don't quite know where it's heading. I mean, I love that when that happens. And with a band, especially when a band digs in and learns something like that, you get little points of light and difference that from anything I'd imagined writing it, that suddenly let light in, and it's like little shafts of light and a beautiful landscape coming in that you hadn't spotted yourself because somebody else has come in and given their impression of it. So,
just even in the mentioning of these titles and the excitement of these songs and where they are placed in the sequence, Night Song is a defined subconscious sleep, a sleeping type night period where a song is rattling around in your head, and it takes these shifts of, you know, that are just random in respect of the thoughts that you have just before you're dropping off to sleep, and it defines it beautifully. Blackwater reminds me of a Munch painting, or a number of Munch paintings, where he's actually, if people have seen those landscapes or lakescapes that he has, where there's a portrait of somebody nighttime, like the dancers, or you know, where you've got this beautiful reflected moon over the water, and this very summer balmy kind of temperature. And then Magic Piano is like a surfing song to me. It's like a longboard 1970s, you know, Morning of the Earth or Endless Summer type surf film where you've got the chorus kicks in when you're actually just on the last stroke of a paddle and you're just jumping up and actually turning your board onto the flow of the wave. A lot of these songs are incredibly visual to me, or they stimulate me. When we were actually recording them and jamming them up, suddenly there were these little collective conscious, you know, breakthroughs that each member of the band, you could see they were kind of assessing, oh, what does that remind me of? Or where is that taking me, you know, in working out my part or whatever? And the record really has that. I'm really excited about that.
The Art of Longevity is presented with Bowers & Wilkins, the revered British premium audio brand. Bowers & Wilkins makes some of the world's finest audio products, from the iconic 800 series loudspeakers, trusted by Abbey Road Studios for over 40 years, to the flagship PX8 wireless headphones. This is music as the artist intended you to hear it.
So you've made a few classic albums. Making a record now and putting it out into the world in the modern environment, do you still believe in the idea of a classic album? Do you think the industry and the way we listen can accommodate that?
Yeah, I believe it's totally possible. And there are classic albums that still emerge. You know, sometimes they become albums that define an artist for the rest of their lives, and they may have great work in and around them, but, you know, and so a peak becomes a classic album. And sometimes they're not, they sometimes leap out and is immediately obvious that it's a classic album. And sometimes they actually lean into that role over a period of time. I think in general, our records that may have been regarded by some people as classic have taken time for people to find out about. Certainly the first Crowded House record, and I mean, things like Woodface that people, you know, or even Together Alone or whatever, that people have become zealots for haven't been apparent immediately. You know, they just, especially with Crowded House, we were talking about this yesterday and saying that almost inevitably every album that's done well has been a slow boiler. And that requires believing in it when it first comes out, when in the face of, you know, people needing to be convinced yet again. You know, short of being Taylor Swift in this world, or, you know, somebody like that, to get through the noise of everyday life at the moment is harder than it's ever been for people. And little snippets of entertainment and information that get digested really don't allow a lot of time for detailed listening. I accept that. I'm probably the similar. I do find new music, and sometimes it takes me a little while, a few months after it's been around, and I've heard three or four people say, oh man, I'm really enjoying this such a record, and then I'll finally give it a proper listen. And sometimes first impressions are not that obvious either, you know. So music is very subjective depending on the time of day and what's going on in your life. You know, you can find the right time of day for an album sometimes. That's just, it suddenly accommodates or accompanies some beautiful moment. But if you have it on, you know, when you're distracted or something, it can even be an annoyance at times, you know.
It's finding a place in the world now for those slow-burning records because, you know, as a fan, the way I feel like you're kind of almost subjected to listening is you've got to check out three or four records and then you might suspect you like one, but by the next week, there are three or four others.
More to listen to.
And it can just pass you by on the conveyor belt so easily.
Absolutely, yeah. And even people, and we recognize that we have a tremendous amount of goodwill amongst a lot of people and broader audience than people might suspect. But with all the goodwill in the world, you know, like I'm a really seriously big Neil Young fan, but I haven't listened to every record Neil Young's put out. Quite a few I've missed. And I think probably a few really great songs I've missed as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because you sort of get to a point where you've got like those key records in your life and you go, well, I probably don't need any. You
know, like, I know.
And it's, need it's, any more of those.
It's really hard to be completist. Like, you might discover a band for the first time. I mean, you know, a new fan could discover Crowded House now or Gravity Stairs and not go back necessarily.
That's true, yeah. And there's an acceptance of that, and it's harder to So expectations should be sort of moderated for what. But you know, when I make a record, there's always moments in the making of the record, and Nick probably feels the same. That you go, one of the best things we've ever done, and you have to really have that in order to see it through. So your expectations at that moment are quite high. You're going, well, I mean, wait till people hear this. It's going to be. But then, you know, I accept the reality of, you know, hope for the best, don't expect the worst, but, you know, like, and then you keep interesting in the music. My interest is in the music, ultimately, and the live shows give the songs a chance to breathe and put them in front of an audience that you know is going to actually have, where that's been the joy of recent years. And one thing I noticed back in the day, when you have a peak of success, you get your audiences building really quickly. Half the people are there with a pretty detailed knowledge of your music, and half of them are there because it's an event, because you've become successful, and they know the songs, that they're touchstone songs, and they come up and they sing them, and then they don't maybe take any notice for a few years. The great thing about a long career, you know, you have a modest fan base, but they'll turn up every time, and you can take them somewhere, a deep cut on stage, and they'll be delighted, and you don't lose them. They don't go to the bar. Well, not many of them. And they don't drop their phones all of a sudden, which is a real blessing to have an audience that feels like you're tuned in, and you can take them places and they don't mind, you know.
Yeah. And I think also for a band of longevity, as you are, there's a real skill to curating in that way. As you say, you recognize that there's different constituents within the audience, and you've got to keep them all engaged and give them a good night. And that's the way to do it. And I think many bands maybe just don't really take as much opportunity to go back and really curate their catalogue well. Is that something that you're conscious of?
It's really hard to balance when there's a big catalogue. You know, like really you can only, in theory, do, you know, one or two songs from each album. And obviously some albums will want to do four or five because they'll have songs that are key songs for people. So yeah, it's pretty hard to get, but you keep an open playlist going on stage, and actually becoming more and more now, we trust ourselves, and we're becoming a better band on stage, and we know we can dig deep into some of the songs that we don't do that often, and we'll play them really well and really enjoy them. But there's a little bit of balance of giving people the surefire ones. We have had songs where we have shows where we haven't played, you know, we don't play Weather With You or something, and I don't know that many people have that care that much. There's a few maybe, but it will leave one of them out and no one's that bummed.
Yeah, you got a bunch of them, so you can maybe get away with that.
I guess the last batch of touring we did also was in that post-COVID period as well, where there was this other agenda that people had that wanted to go out. Absolutely. And then there were certain demands being made in terms of what you were providing. You know, as your role in a post-COVID environment was to supply this very special event that a lot of people who came to shows possibly weren't the normal concert-going crowd. You know, they were just actually wanting to go out.
Yeah, I mean, so slightly smaller venues sometimes, and that's the attraction of, if you in Australia, and even sometimes in the UK, we play quite big outdoor locations where there's an event aspect to it, you know, like in Australia, maybe a vineyard or something, and people come along and they, you know, they bring their mates and they sit around and they get drunk. And there it's harder to go deep whereas theatres, where you know you've got everyone that's bought a ticket in a theatre has pretty much come to experience Crowded House in a bit broader sense. So that gives you a bit more latitude. But, you know, I mean, they can all be great. But I probably marginally do prefer a seated audience in a theatre, in a lovely theatre.
So the affirmation and feedback for new songs will come principally from when you play them live. How else do you feel you can figure out how Gravity Stairs is going to go down?
I mean, it used to be as obvious as do we have Radio 2 or Radio 1 playlist back in the day? And it was all or nothing in a way, you know, like if you didn't have that, you might get some regional stations or something. It was all about radio play. Now, having not many expectations for radio play, which it's been, you know, harder to come by, there's all these really weird gatekeepers and alternative angles and playlists on Spotify and And they all add up to something, but I've got no conception of how that works. In a way, it's slightly liberating because I don't care as much. You know, like, I don't know about all the key playlists on Spotify. They haven't entered my frame. So I don't ask, did we get the alternative easy listening format on, I don't know about it.
It's really hard to tell, right? Yeah. I mean, I've had so many discussions with bands who are maybe not, they don't have the length of career and the catalog that you have. Maybe they're halfway there. And they don't even know how to define success anymore. Do you have a feel for what you're happy with?
It's largely comes down to the tours. In the end, I mean, the reviews, you know, there's a nervy period when the reviews are coming out. You don't know how people are relating to your new thing. You've had moments, as I said before, of thinking it's the greatest thing you've ever done. So in a way, anything less than a 5-star review is a slight disappointment. You know, we'll take a 4-star. But if they don't get it, but inevitably they don't all get it. And some people will only listen to something half pie and they might not even like it, which But reviews are even a little bit less a defining factor nowadays. I mean,
absolutely. See, that's the other thing. I mean, you know, you think about Pitchfork and the fact that
they've gone down, haven't they?
They've
been bought and they're changing.
They've been subsumed into Gentleman's Quarterly magazine. But, you know, they kind of built their reputation on these kind of, you know, 7-point-something, 8-point-something reviews. Yeah. And I guess you're right. They're just not as significant.
Seemingly not. I think there's certain types of bands that really benefit from great reviews. And we've had really good reviews. We've had people not like what we do at various points. It's been sort of a bit hit and miss, but we're not that kind of band that's entirely reliant on. We were a band that benefited from some radio play. We've become a band, I believe, that is the people that follow us have kind of developed quite a strong personal connection to the music, and they come to the shows and they absorb the records, and they're really important. The new records are important to a certain selection of those people. Ultimately, that's really is at the end of the day is all that matters. You have high hopes, you know, that it might somehow slide into the side of the zeitgeist.
That's a good phrase.
And knock on the door.
Steal that one, Neil.
Yeah, but I'm realistic about it.
I want to go back to Gravity Stairs just for a second because there's a passage in the album, I think it's in the second, would be on the second side with the track I Can't Keep Up With You, which I really love. It's got a real swagger to it. And then it's followed by a track called Thirsty. And I thought there was a bit of a sort of Wilco passage in there for me. And I wondered, are you influenced by bands that you influenced?
I think the family, Liam and Elroy, initially introduced me to, I was aware of Wilco and I knew they were a quality band, but they introduced me to, Alpha Bravo, I can never remember the whole title.
Foxtrot. Yeah, whatever, yeah.
Yeah, and yeah, yeah. Ghosts is Born, the two albums that were pivotal at that moment, two in a row that were outstanding, beautiful mix of experimental and pop and just, you know, all the things you want. And Jeff Tweedy's voice is very affecting, I think. He's got one of those voices that really you lean into, you want to hear what he's saying, and he's got a tenderness in it. So, yeah, I became quite fond of them at the time. And then they came across to New Zealand and actually took part in a thing that I did called Seven Wheels Collide, took up an invitation. We got to know them personally, and then I don't listen to their records anymore. But it's not because I don't like them.
Exactly what we were talking about before, right? Yeah. The two, and, I mean, they've got 10 others, but, I mean, who have you got the time to explore those?
And some of them are really good. I don't listen to them. I have listened to them and I've enjoyed lots of songs off them. But if there's echoes of the kind of record making or what they're going for in there, I'm happy about that because they always have that ability to slip off for a little moment from you think you know what you're listening to and all of a sudden they'll slip into something, you know, go into the bedroom and put on a negligee out of the blue.
Yeah, it's nice when that happens.
Yeah, it is. I mean, we
metaphorically on a record.
We like that. We like that to be part of the process as well. I think maybe one day we'd make a whole record and a negligee might be fine.
Okay, on to fame and longevity. So we've been talking about streaming a little bit. Neil, I read a couple of the interviews that talked about you coming off of the back of the Fleetwood Mac tour that you joined in 2018-19 and appreciating the way they'd reconnected and found a new audience and were able to kind of lean into that, if you like. I've been dwelling on that a lot with going back into the Crowded House catalogue. You know, in this day and age where everything's gone huge, you mentioned Taylor Swift, you look at Spotify and streaming, and at the top of the pile are these sort of global stars where they're known everywhere. And in a way, Crowded House comes out strangely underrated in a sense. Do you sort of see that as part of your mission to kind of see what you can do with that catalogue and your legacy now with the way that you can connect to new audiences?
It's a mystery how that transpires. We had a moment probably at a certain point where we were poised to be, you know, be the full arena band. Not that we were successful to that level everywhere. We had America was always, well, initially that's where we became successful, but then that became the harder market for some reason to get into. And, you know, and I pulled back from it for a number of reasons, but there was some self-preservation mentality, which I can't explain about that. Certain people pull back from expansive success because they sense there's something dangerous in it. Maybe I'm one of those people. I think the band Radiohead, who I much admire, had a moment where they did that. They could have gone down a path and become the U2 of their generation, and I think they didn't. They decided they didn't want that and recoiled about it. And you know, they became a better, more interesting band because of it.
Yeah, sort of self-correction.
Yeah, I like to think that was part of my reasoning. You know, everyone had a different view on that time, but it, you know, it messes with your head getting successful. I didn't handle it always very well. But to get back to your question, the way to get Crowded House into the minds of new generations and to spread the awareness of is mysterious. But the only way I can figure out how to approach it is to just keep my head down and work as at the highest level I possibly can and make the band as important in that process as it can be and understand that there is little moments of good fortune that emerge when you work hard and turn up every day, and you want to make sure you recognize and you've got the, you know, in musical terms, you make sure you got the microphone on and got record buttoned down. In career terms, you make sure you're present in the moment and you see the opportunity. And nothing is worse than looking at somebody from the outside who seems desperate to, that's going, look at me too much as they get older and trying to compete with the kids. So trying to maintain some dignity in the midst of that is a really important thing. And I just think it either comes around or it doesn't, but I think the best thing you can do is just keep your head down and keep trying to produce really good work. I think what we have managed to do, and I really believe that we have managed to create really worthwhile music beyond what would be considered a normal lifespan for a band. So I already think we're sort of halfway to claiming some kind of position in the thing. And you go mad if you start thinking about it all being whether you've made some list or some, you know, that would be disheartening, whether you're nominated for Grammys or all that stuff. Some really fine, wonderful people that end up with huge appreciation don't get nominated for Grammys. And it's always worth remembering that. It's a weird touchstone.
Yeah, I mean, those events have always been subject to some controversial debate, but now I think it's more existential than that. It's sort of, well, what do they represent? Because there's just all this great music out there and some of it's chosen to be put on parade, but most of it isn't.
There's some of the artists that are in that sphere are really good, and you don't have any problem with them being celebrated. And sometimes it seems like it's a little closed community of people all employing the same methods and tricks, you know, huge writing teams and record making factories and
writing to a very, very tight formula for the streaming age.
It's really common way to approach pop music, and there are some great results from that. You know, like you get a song like Toxic from Britney Spears. That's as old now, but that was the dawning of a new kind of way of that. And that's really admirable. I love that song. You know, it's cool. It, it'll last quite well.
You can't argue with it as being a great song.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Now, a lot of it is about still the songs. I mean, those big kind of comebacks, if you like, or those moments of resurgence that, you know, Fleetwood Mac have had and Kate Bush have had have come from, okay, let's just choose one from the basket of amazing songs.
Yeah, there's accidental revelations that happen with old songs that, you know, they get one play. And I think with Dreams has had quite a few revelations over the year, but there was that one that was quite uncanny, that of the guy on the skateboard, was it, with the can of something, singing Dreams, miming along to Dreams. And it
he was being pulled along his van, wasn't he, on roller skates or a skateboard or something with, it was a bizarre drink. I mean, it was like, I think part of this whole myth was that what he was drinking was kind of weird.
Yeah, I mean, those are the things, you can't plan that stuff. It does happen. And you know, we've had some lovely moments of Don't Dream It's Over getting, suddenly becoming reinvigorated by, I mean, just the other day, U2 did it in Las Vegas. And,
oh, amazing.
You know, we've had a lot of different, Ariana Grande did it at the Benefit concert in Manchester. And so.
Yeah, you don't need a billion streams when you know that U2's covering it in Vegas. Anyway, that's probably going to happen now.
Thanks for listening to The Art of Longevity. I hope you're enjoying the conversation so far. Please take a moment to rate the show, leave a review on Apple Podcasts if that's where you listen, and do spread the word. Also, you can sign up via the Song Sommelier webpage for our newsletter, artwork, and much more. Back to the conversation.
So one of the quotes I read in previous interviews, I think it was actually from a Guardian review of Dreamers Are Waiting, your 2021 record, which said, "Crowded House exists on their own island now, a place to take refuge from the rest of the world when it all becomes too enormous and terrifying to bear thinking about." Is that what we're talking about here, or is that just putting it in rather dramatic terms?
We are getting away with it. I give thanks for the way I can live now in terms of you asking the question about success, how you measure that. And being able to make another record, being able to go on to falling into that zone of collaborating with others, and I really give thanks. That's as successful as I can be personally, being able to have that opportunity every time that it does come up. And Neil has an incredible work ethic as an artist to maintain all of the machinations to, well, if we do this, then we have to do this and we have to do that. And I sort of fall into place because I kind of stopped, in a way, wanting to live or be a part of a hub, as it were, like knowing what the industry requires. You know, back in the day, I knew every new release that was coming out and who was getting played at radio and who was big in the dance clubs and who was getting nominations for different, and I loved award shows. You know, I'd actually turn up to these places in the right frame of mind and hang out with the others and, you know, meet people. Just, I remember sparking up friendships with different musicians just purely from being on the award show kind of circuit there for a while in the 90s, perhaps early 90s. But, you know, I now live in a kind of not reclusive, but I mean, we kind of do. I mean, I live in Ireland, Neil lives in New Zealand, and it there is a kind of a reclusion of having a practice that we share, in the sense that we have a studio that we go to each day and work on whatever. I mean, mine's mostly sound work that I do, but I also have half my studio is visual. And when I'm required, I will do artwork. I keep logbooks and journals and stuff when I'm touring. And in fact, that's probably the thing that I look forward to the most about touring, is being able to go back to my hotel room and back into my little studio where I've got a little setup. You know, I'd like to set up my hotel room. And I use the excuse that, well, that keeps me out of the bar, you know.
You know, I think we've lucked out, really. Yeah, what follow that thing. We have a lot of goodwill, and we have a lot of people listening to the music and consistently listening to the music, and the fans are really, they're good people, you know, like we're pretty lucky with the fans. They're nice people and they are respectful, and, you know, by and large, there's a few crazy people everywhere. But and the thing I noticed about being on stage with Fleetwood Mac is that there's nothing that different about the experience of audience to band. They were, you know, obviously a stratospheric success that we never achieved, but it's just a band, and there's just these people, and making, and every night we were trying to, and that band particularly, John McVie and Mick and Christine, they're not flash session players. They're just like, they've formed this thing that they had a really beautiful sound, and so I related to it, but I also kind of thought, well, they're not having as much fun as they could be as well, because they're turning up and still playing really well, and they're really delivering it, but they're not excited about making the next record anymore.
Yeah.
And in fact, that probably was quite a daunting prospect for them, the idea of being in the studio.
I know what you mean. It feels like they had really big obligations on them.
Yeah.
Whenever they went out there and did a tour. As you say, you, for one way or another, you've sort of swerved that. It feels like you're obliged to do, okay, maybe play a few of those hits when you play live, but you can leave one or two out. Well, yeah, but you're obliged to do what you want next and just enjoy doing it.
And also just be able to really get excited about going and make a new record, you know, and know that the band's all tuned in on that process. And yeah, like Nick's brother, I don't know, yeah, I can relate the story, came to visit us in Melbourne. He's a musician, a very good songwriter, has his own experience of bands. And he was kind of made a point of saying he was so blown away about how we enjoyed each other's company so much. And it's not that common in bands, especially bands probably that come back together, and I don't judge anyone for it, but coming together because later in their lives they realize that, oh, there's still a really good big audience for this. And it is the age of bands returning from the 80s and the 90s and going back out, and some of them do it really well, but I don't know how many get the beautiful opportunity and good fortune to enjoy each other's company and go, well, we could make another record right now. Some do, you know, and some have. But it's a pretty special thing, opportunity, and perhaps that's come from having a, you know, the expectations and the demands are lower slightly, and it's a healthier place to maintain good humor and good relationships.
It feels like you did cross the Rubicon in that way. I'm wondering when you felt that happened. Do you think it was when you came back from the original hiatus, which was that sort of 10-year break between, was it 96, 2006, around that time? And maybe you were surprised by the reception you got then. I don't know. But at what point did you feel like, okay, we're here and we can just continue doing this?
Yeah, well, it's attached. It was kind of, maybe I needed to be reminded by the absence of something, that there is something inherent in having a band that is worth putting a lot of effort into, and not always easiest way to conduct your life, to be accommodating those relationships. But there's something in the way that relationship becomes part of what people like about the music. And if you go and see a band play and they're still getting on with each other, or even if they're not, sometimes that's entertaining too. But everyone in the band's interesting. It's not like going to, you can go and see a great show from a solo artist, and the band might be one little eccentric member, a sax player might do a funny dance or something. But generally speaking, you don't care about watching the rest of the band. With a band, that's the joy of it, as you go, and actually that's, everybody has got something, there's some role being, really important role being played. I think that's the attraction of bands. And it's also within the process. At times it doesn't feel that easy to accommodate that many opinions, but something about the result justifies the work. And so there's things that I'll do on my own as well that are just suddenly, you feel like this needs to be a solo thing. But having the band as a living entity, and, you know, it feels like a real achievement. And it did come from that period where we regathered, and actually was something quite significant in that, and Time on Earth and that tour reconnected with something. We were also paying homage to some original spark or flame that we had in the absence of Paul Hester, whose, you know, tragic departure put some kind of motivation back in my mind, to be completely honest.
Do you have recurring themes in your songs that are still coming back around? I'm thinking even back to Gravity Stairs. Are there themes that have come back around from those early days? Or
I rely very much on the first ideas dropping as subconscious things and then following those threads. Sometimes they're quite hard to follow as well, but I've learned to trust that they'll end up by some process of concentration, skullduggery, bluff, flashes of great inspiration. It's something that is authentic and true for me, even if it doesn't make sense on a literal terms. But and some of the same, you know, the tinge of melancholy and then the chance of redemption are the recurring themes for me, really. I think the trying to burst out of your own boundaries recurs as a theme for me a little bit, and trying to find the connection between the people in your lives. And yeah, I as much as I can say, that would be some of the themes that keep recurring.
There's a Reddit group, the Thread Crowded House, which has obviously got some super fans on there.
Oh, yeah.
And I asked them to put a few questions out there. And one was around your songwriting, Neil. The very famous songs that people know you for have that kind of impressionistic, observational quality to them. Has that gotten harder over time, just to notice those little things around you, almost out of normal life, that inspire you to go on and write a song?
It's got harder in some ways to write songs, but I just see that as a challenge for some kind of endurance that you have to muster, and the opportunities still come, but you're kind of fighting harder for them a little bit. But if you if I'm turning up to work a little bit more often and a little bit more focused, and actually what the one of the benefits of the COVID lockdown was, it enabled me to go to work every day and have no distractions, which I loved. You know, like, I've heard other people say so too. You feel a little bit guilty for saying it, because for some people it was hell. But for me, it was an opportunity not to have any other responsibilities in my life, and just get, because you do, I really have to dig deep initially and at certain points to get over the hump. But endurance has been my friend in that regard, because it'd be easy to settle for something. And who knows, it may even be that something that I think's not quite right and I work on really hard. It might have been just as good before I started working on it really hard. But I think that it's little gains are really worth it, and so I'll go for them every time. And then Nick will testify to the amount of moments where you think you know what you've got, and then all of a sudden I'll send something down the line and it'll have a completely different verse or a different tempo or a different feel. And by and large, everyone comes with me. They kind of recognize that it's come from somewhere worthwhile, and then they'll jump in and put their stamp on it in some form, or just go, yep, that sounds good, or no, it's, you've gone too far. And you know, Mitchell Froom's probably the one who quite often, and actually everybody to some degree, but Mitchell is putting his producer's hat on, will come back and go, oh my God, I think you've gone, this has gone too long now. It's losing this thing that it had here and there. And he's probably right. I the danger is over polishing, but yeah. The reward for really getting deep into something is, I think that in every sphere, and I think there's probably artists in the visual arts that, and Nick would probably be one of those people, the reward, you know, can seem unbelievably pedantic sometimes, the kind of lengths you go to get the process underway and to achieve the sort of thing you're looking for, and the trial and error of that and all that. And at times you look at yourself and go, what are you doing? You know, this is not pure expression. This is some kind of
overthinking.
But then you have beautiful breakthroughs that come from that level of detail. And you know, playing like a child, thinking, editing like an adult is a simple process, really. Sometimes when you do have those moments of refashioning something, completely taking it apart and putting it back together again, you can be childish about that. And it's not all about being academic or too scientific about it. You can approach it again. Like, I'll have moments where I go, something's not quite right. But the way that I'll find the breakthrough will sometimes be just taking most of the instruments out and, you know, having a joint or something, maybe. But, you know, just getting my head into a different sphere and just re-singing nonsense on top of something, and you'll have a little revelation that come to light. Ah, there's a little rhythmic pattern that I haven't noticed before that's possible here, and suddenly it's a different song, you know.
Maybe that's always been there in the quality of your songs to some extent, because it's another question here from one of the fans on Reddit, which was about Woodface and the choice of Chocolate Cake as the first single. And I'm also thinking of Crowded House, the debut album, where someone decided Mean to Me was a good idea for the first single. These are good songs, but you did have other songs on those records that became monumentous hits. Yeah. Do you think there's something in just sort of being able to know what it is in a song that's going to connect? Is that difficult?
I think once I've finished an album and finished a song, I lose quite a bit of objectivity about where it fits and how it. So the next phase is quite mysterious. And if you've got suddenly a whole lot of players in the mix going, oh, this is great, this is great, we need to do this, we need song, we need an up song for, you know, such and such radio thing. I was prone to letting go of my own personal judgments of what was worthy and going on with the prevailing wind, you know. And there are some moments now I look back on and I go, well, that wasn't smart. And if somebody was asking me for advice about how to choose a first thing, I'd say, what's your favourite song? You know, or with Ojai on this record, you know, I think, I don't know if it's my favourite song, but it was one I always saw as being like, well, it's just, it's uplifting and it's engaging in a slightly different way than any song I've written. So I could attach myself to that. And, you know, I think the thing is about Chocolate Cake is I think we thought it was kind of funny. You know, it had a kind of humour about it and therefore it was different, and maybe it was really fun to write, and my brother and I really enjoyed performing it, and I think we enjoyed the recording of it. It just wasn't a melodic song in the nature of what people were hoping for, you know, some people were. So yeah, and it got us into trouble really, because America didn't like, no.
Well, you've got to have those little patches in your career where you do get into trouble and you then overcome something.
It didn't go down well. You know, even the review in Rolling Stone referred to, well, it's all very well for them, something about it's all very well for them to come over here and, you know, get an audience
Americans
going.
Don't
but
like that. We know they
can
don't
like
be sensitive.
Being criticized. They're very sensitive.
The Art of Longevity is recorded at Cube West Studios in Acton and sometimes at the Cube East Studios in London's Canary Wharf. Cube is the world's first members studio for musicians, podcasters, and content creators, and it's a real sanctuary for London's independent, inspired creators. It's a real pleasure to record the show here.
Nick, if you could climb back into the musical time machine and go back and fix something, whether it's a minor detail or a major thing, is there something that pops into your head? I told you it was a musical mind gym. I didn't tell you it was a musical time machine.
I mean, there are constant things like that for me, but not necessarily musical. You know, like moments where I've just suddenly have this memory of just being an absolute idiot and saying something completely inappropriate and marginalizing someone without realizing, and just whatever, as my father would say, you're always putting yourself across. And I never quite I've remembered that for the longest, you know, it's a character trait, a needy character trait that I've always had. But in terms of Crowded House, no, there's not a single moment like that. There are, although, moments where I say, we got that right. There's only a handful of songs, I think, that we were absolutely bang on in the studio all collectively at the same time, with the exact same sense of our parts revealing themselves in a really shared moment. And that's a good take. And because we've always recorded linearly, in the sense that we go into a rehearsal room and we work the songs out from Neil's musings, you know, demos or whatever, and we work them out, and then we work our parts out, and then we record them from start to finish and see how the arrangement works and where there's a rise, where there's a drop off, you know, that sort of thing. So just being in the right place at the right time all together, I can think of a handful. I mean, Into Temptation is one of those. I can't think of songs that I just think, no, we really stuffed that up. I mean, I always thought It's Only Natural was never as good a recording as we'd made. And yet I listen to that now and think, wow, we're really on. That was really good. Mitchell called that take, as I recall. We did it a number of times in slightly different tempos. But Mitchell kind of, I seem to be reminded that he made that call, that was a great take. And it actually is. I can listen to most things without cringing. But that wasn't always the way.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was driving at. Sometimes it is that. It's just the way in which a particular record, album, or song sounds that you feel like you didn't get right. But sometimes that's the take that works. So that's the way it is. And you can always rework it live.
There's kind of aesthetic aspects of production that get dated. You know, there's a few records that we made where you go, well, we made decisions based on what was the latest sort of style of snare sound, and they don't
that's
last.
The 80s for you.
You know, the 80s, I guess there's some things. But you know, even that, sometimes I don't think I labour over any regrets about those things. And also a couple of songs, maybe too many on a couple of records that you go, it would have been a leaner record, better record as a leaner record. Like Woodface, I feel like that a little bit. There was 14 songs on Woodface, I think. It would have been better as a 12-song record. And I know which ones I would have got rid of, but that's all by the by.
Well, that's a good debate for the fans.
Yeah.
That's out there, you know.
They have those debates too. That's the sort of thing that they do.
Yeah, which...
They go, which song would you like? Do you like the least of any of the songs? And then, you know...
And, you know, which is your favourite Crowded House album? And there seems to be a lot of varying views around that. But, I mean, Woodface was 1991, right? So it was like the peak of the CD 14, 16-track era. So
I guess it would have been
really difficult to resist that at the time.
Well, that's a lot of people's favourite record, but there's a lot of people that it's not their favourite record. You know, like Together Alone has a pretty big coterie of fans. And and then sometimes the most obscure songs people ask me about and go, oh, it was such an important song for me that. And you go, like, wow, I didn't even make a record. This is a song called Lost Island, which is, didn't make Time on Earth, I think. And I actually don't quite know why, because I really like it as well.
Well, on that subject, I mean, I know we're coming up for time. A couple of quick things. So listening back to your catalogue in preparation for this, which is always great, so it's just to listen to it in a linear fashion, I came across Afterglow, which I hadn't really paid much attention to.
Yeah.
But it's like, it's absolutely great. It's like, how did all these songs not end up on a record?
Yeah.
And I want to come back to it in the modern context, because we've had so much of bands releasing an album and then 6 months later another one comes, or there's a string of songs that came from the same sessions. You must have lots more songs that you have recorded either recently or back in the day. Is there a plan to do something with those songs?
Usually songs that don't make the record don't get completely finished. They kind of they sit in a kind of three quarters finished mode, because you at some point decide it's just not quite right and you leave it for another day. So whether or not they ever emerge in that shape is debatable. What we did do at some point, when we put out a re-release, I think maybe of the CDs, we put out, for each album, had its CD of demos, and I've got lots of them. And they all have, almost all the demos have some kind of atmosphere, character that, you know, is really compelling, and they're not finished songs and they're flawed. But I'm really, when I listened to a couple of those that occurred around, probably towards the end, like a post Together Alone, when I was making Try Whistling This, and then there was another period around the Time on Earth period when that became quite convoluted because it became a band record. It started as a solo record. Nick got involved at a certain point. We did all those songs with Joey Warrenker, and they all turned up on that rarities disc associated with that album. I was thinking, you know, there's almost as good a record in those, you know, in some ways of looking at it, maybe even a better record in what we left off. And I'm guilty of that sometimes. I kind of go, well, it's not quite right, so we'll try another take. We'll do a different version of it now. And it might not have been quite right either, but the different version, it becomes better in some ways, but maybe it loses a little bit of some original atmosphere as well. So, you know, I always battle with that. I listen to some of my original demos and go, something was lost in that process. But not all, but sometimes, yeah.
It's a difficult balance though, isn't it? Because you want to get the best version of that song that you're working on at that time. But it's an interesting era going into. You mentioned Neil Young, Neil, and I'm a fan of Def Leppard. They have a thing now called The Vault, in which they've curated all of those things. I mean, right back to, you know, the photographer on this particular tour and, you know, what he captured on that tour to, you know, demos and outtakes and, you know, the story of each member of the band almost. I mean, are you tempted to do some of that? Do you feel like, even if it wasn't you, you know, you had someone come in and do it for you, but to just do that archiving and kind of sum up more than just the records and the tours that we see?
There is quite a lot of that on my website. There's a Neil Finn website that this guy Jeremy Ansell manages in New Zealand, and he's really good archivist, and there's quite a lot of material on there, old videos. I have taken some of it off because I sort of started to think, maybe it's better if it's not too available. And then I can do something with it at some point when it'll be fresh again, you know.
Yeah.
So I did actually. And there was a month where I had a TV channel going, and everything that I could think of that was worth looking at ran continuously 24 hours a day and there was days worth of material. And I don't know, it probably didn't even repeat that much. There's so much material. That ran for a month and people just tune in at any point. And I did a radio thing as well. So all of the obscurities, all the live gigs, and you could just tune in at any point and it seldom repeated. And that was quite good. But I kept it limited to that because I just wanted to not, yeah, I don't know. I'm on two minds about that. You know, some people, Mitchell would have it that you don't reveal any of the work in progress and only the end result that's ever worth seeing. I sort of think if it's properly curated, it's a resource, even if it's only for the really hardcore fans.
Yeah.
It's an incredible resource. And there are, you know, I think I equate it with, I always compare it to the Beatles, you know, they may not have decided that it was good, but a lot of their demos that have come out are amazing. You know, there's the pre-White Album demos that they recorded largely in India, I think, that are just fantastic, you know, and I've got them on. I love listening to those, and I'm, you know, I'm not a hardcore Beatles zealot. I don't have everything they ever did, even, but
because you think there can't be anything else, but then, you know, the Get Back movies kind of demonstrated, there is.
And the origins of things are interesting, ultimately, if they're, because sometimes the thing about when a song emerges, the first dawning of a song is like you're really willing it into the world. And so you're leaning into the idea with a kind of an intensity of feeling that sometimes can't keep up, you know, in the process. It becomes more of a process of building something with a beautiful architecture and the song certainly comes through, but that first imagining is like you really leaning into an idea and making it, just giving it some feeling so you can believe in it enough to finish it.
I'm just reminded of that job of being an art destroyer, like a person who is employed by a great artist, a fine artist, to destroy the work.
The work that they don't want anybody to see.
They don't want anyone to see, you know. And I mean, Lucian Freud had one and Francis Bacon had one. And I'm sure, you know, Hockney probably has one, you know, in terms of British artists. I was really unaware that that was a job description, is someone full-time job to actually just destroy the work that, you know.
Yeah, I'd like to read the job advert, you know, to see what kind of personal characteristics they're looking for.
There's something to be said for that mentality. I would probably, though, choose to destroy a couple of records, finished records, before I destroy the demo of that record. I would maybe, if I was, you know, and that's not possible, so as a theory.
Interesting. Okay, I've only got you for two more minutes. So, Nick, just tell me what you're most excited about for this year and then beyond that.
I'm looking forward to touring again, like being, you know, to playing gigs and so on. I was really very stressed out by getting the album cover finished and then all of the subsequent assets, as they're referred to in terms of logos and bits and bobs. So now I've kind of relaxed and I'm really looking forward to getting back into the zone of being, you know, an all dancing, singing bass player again,
in
touring
a kilt.
The world.
Man in a kilt.
Well, I'm not sure if I'm going to break out the kilt again. I think I need a knee lift, Neil. I really do.
I think one of those Japanese
samurai suits. Kind of one of those pleated, long.
Something will come up.
Something will come up.
Not the kilt, hopefully.
He'll be sashaying his way across the stage in some lovely outfit, no doubt.
And Neil, how about you?
I'm really looking forward to playing these songs on stage because we already got an inkling of that last year. We played some of them on an American tour and they really are going to suit the stage and the band, and I think they're going to take on a whole new lease of life. So yeah, that's enough to look forward to, and I'm getting around and seeing the people. We'll have my family. I'll have my family with me, you know, Liam and Elroy in the band, and Sharon will be on in the road. That's exciting. That's all I could look for. And a couple of little journeys to exotic destinations in the midst of it.
Absolutely. Got to squeeze those in always.
Yep.
All right. Well, look, guys, it's been a pleasure having you on. I wish you all the best.
That was a good conversation.
Well,
thanks.
Yeah. And look forward to whatever you do next.
All right. Nice one.
Thank you.
A real pleasure.
Cheers, man.
Thank you.